Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Work moves fast. From emails and reports to proposals and updates, you're expected to think clearly, write confidently, and get it right the first time. And every message counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It gives you everything you need to think, write, and finish in one place. Or anywhere you type and text. You'll never have to switch tools or tabs. Grammarly's AI agents are built for how you work and where you work, so you can find the right words, adjust your tone, and predict how your message might land before you hit send. Your ideas will get a boost, while still sounding natural, credible, and just the way you want. For nearly 17 years, Grammarly has been the standard for responsible AI. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this interview of the Lotus Eaters. And I'm pleased to be interviewing again Dr. Benedict Beckel, the author of Western Self-Contempt, Ecophobia in the Decline of Civilizations by Northern Illinois University Press. And today we're going to talk a bit about something a bit different, but not entirely different. We're going to talk about multiculturalism and its philosophy, but also how it has been practiced in the US, but also in Europe. And I'm sure we'll have a lot of doom and gloom to discuss about the European setting. But also I would like to ask you about some of the reasons of your current optimism regarding the United States, or at least that's how I have heard by a mutual friend. So one question is, what are your late projects now? What are the projects you're working on lately?
So currently, first of all, thank you so much for having me again. It's a pleasure always to speak.
It's a pleasure.
My current projects are a book on aesthetics. It's actually based on a book that I wrote, piece of juvenilia, if you will, in my early 20s on aesthetics. And that was because aesthetics was really my first great passion in philosophy. But now, obviously, many years later, I've developed since then, hopefully anyway. So now I'm revamping it, additions, deletions, revisions, and so on, making a new work out of it. And it's basically about the relationship between art and society. So it's aesthetics and political philosophy, if you will, combined, what one teaches us about the other. And that's right. That's going to come out soon, I hope. I mean, I've almost finished writing it, and then the long process of trying to get it published is going to begin. So it might still be a while, but that's my main project right now. And then I have smaller projects on conservatism, for example. There's a book chapter on conservatism and pseudo-conservatism in the United States. That's an academic book chapter that's going to come out soon as part of a Sammelband, a collected volume. So, and I might build on that as well to write a little more about conservatism and that whole political philosophy.
I'm very interested to see how it's going to eventuate. And I really hope you the best of luck with the publishing process, which I know is a living hell. But you did it for the first time. So I think that chances are you have better chances now, I think.
Hopefully, yeah. Cornell University Press, which was you mentioned Northern Illinois University Press, which is the imprint of Cornell University Press. I met some very good people there, especially the main philosophy editor there was very open to the message. So there is still hope or islands of sanity, if you will, within academia. And I think once the first major book, I'd written a few other books, but they were sort of more niche. This was the first one that really was more for a broader audience and so on. And once one has gotten one's foot in the door, hopefully it'll be easier the next time around. We'll see.
Excellent. Right. Yeah. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. Thank
right.
You.
So I want us to talk a bit about multiculturalism. And the reason why I want us to talk about it is because it's one of the main isms of late, and I have been excessively critical of about it. But I think that whenever we're talking about abstract concepts, we are very vague, and there always lies there the need for developing a conception of what we mean by when we're using an abstract term. The same is with diversity. So in circles that we both move, presumably diversity is a word that when is heard, we're supposed to go boo. But on the other hand, I think the most philosophically apt reaction to this is to basically ask, what do we mean? What is diversity? Diversity of what? And whether it's good or bad. So when it comes to multiculturalism, I think a really good idea is to just sit down from a philosophical perspective and start talking about it, interrogate multiculturalism. And I want to ask you several questions about it. So what is multiculturalism? And most probably we will need to start by asking, what is a culture? Because multiculturalism essentially means many cultures. So what would you say a culture is?
So, I take a fairly Wittgensteinian approach, if you will, to these questions, meaning that I don't take one essential definition, but that basically a family of resemblances, to use his kind of language when we try to define something. Late Wittgenstein, anyway, as opposed to early Wittgenstein, who, as you know, was rejected by Wittgenstein himself. But anyway, the... my understanding of culture, and I think it's important to point out that the people who speak in favor of multiculturalism, they themselves usually have rather a poor understanding of what they mean by it. And it's just sort of a general feeling that they have of what a society should look like, but they don't really haven't crystallized it very clearly in their minds. Most of them, anyway, have not. But what we mean by a culture is a shared language, history, values, and also more external things like dress and cuisine and things like that. But it's important to note that, and this is a mistake that one sees both on the left and the right. The left tends to understand culture as something very superficial. The fact that in Asia they'll use chopsticks as opposed to knife and fork over here, which of course is a part of a culture, but it's an extremely superficial part of culture. Of course, culture is something that goes much deeper. If that's how you understand culture in such a superficial way, then of course there should be no problem combining them. Similarly, on the right, it's not as grave a mistake, but it's still a mistake that you hear a lot on the right, where people say that, well, culture is simply a question of holding a certain set of beliefs. For example, if we believe in democracy or in the equality of the sexes and so on, then we share a culture. And again, there is some truth in both of these conceptions, both on the left and on the right, but it's so much more than that. Being a part of a culture isn't just those things. It is also the shared history, for example. This is why you cannot simply say that, okay, I believe in secularism, and therefore I can now live in France and be a Frenchman, for example. It's much more than that. It's a shared language. It's a shared history. It's a shared sense of identity. The idea that that we have been here for centuries, for millennia, even, and all of that is a part of culture. So we can't say that it's any one of those things. It's all of those things together. And if we say that, if we isolate one of those aspects, then we haven't fully understood what a culture is. Now, I say that, of course, with a certain caveat. There are certain differences between Europe and the United States in this regard. Obviously, in the United States, we are more of a melting pot. It's a cliche, but of course, it's true. I'm an immigrant to the United States myself. So obviously, my ancestors have not been on this soil for millennia, not even centuries. But basically, in order to understand a culture, we at least have to understand that it's something that approaches that conception of it. And then in different parts of the world, you can find certain exceptions, and you would have to revise the understanding of it to a certain extent based on the particular circumstances that obtain in that place, in that time and place. But by and large, to understand what a culture is, we have to keep all of these conceptions in mind at the same time.
Excellent. So I think it's important to dwell on it a bit, because you're saying that a culture requires commonality of language and a shared history. What was I?
Yeah,
right.
I think
so I think mentioning also Wittgenstein, but also the way of approaching language, I think it's also tied to a notion of a way of life within the context that you mentioned, but also it features in several ways, because people use the term culture in order to capture all sorts of different things. So for instance, in ways that you could say in some cases, the same culture counts as involving a host of cultures, or from another lens, it could just be one, it could just involve a dominant monoculture. But I think that, for instance, we could be talking about punk culture, road culture, rock and roll culture, all sorts of cultures and groups within a society that practice different ways of life, but also have shared commonalities. And in virtue of those shared commonalities, they can function as a society. And from a perspective, they can be seen as multicultural, but not necessarily from another perspective. So I think when we're talking about multiculturalism and culture, I think we need to discern between contexts and the civilizational context, the political, the social, the countercultural. Sometimes that sounds like an oxymoron, but I think that we can draw meaning out of it. Because the reason I say this is because a lot of people who reject one form of multiculturalism in the domain of, for instance, of society at large, they think that automatically every form of multiculturalism may be wrong. And they want to occupy the perspective that everyone has to live in the same way, believe the same things. It's just a culture that has shared genetics and a shared origin, and it just is incredibly monolithic. And I think that this isn't the case historically speaking. But on the other hand, there are enough problems for that to render particular forms of multiculturalism incredibly problematic. So would you say that this makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with everything you just said. And that's also why in the very beginning, I rejected an essentialist understanding of culture, saying that we kind of have to look a little, take a somewhat more complex view of the phenomenon and look at how it plays out in various at various times and places. And I especially your point about various types of subcultures, like the, you know, whatever it was that you said, all these in Germany, of course, they attach the word Kultur to everything. And so that's probably having lived many years in that country, I that resonates a lot with me, because everything is a culture in the German language, building culture and train station culture and so on. So that's certainly true. And as I also mentioned, for example, in the United States, obviously the situation is a bit different from Europe and even within Europe. And of course, this is what the left always loves to point out when they say, oh, people have immigrated back and forth over centuries. Of course, again, there is some truth to that. But of course, that doesn't mean that it has been on anything approaching the same level as it is now, or that it justifies the kinds of levels that we see now. There is, of course, part of, if we take a broader view of the West, of course, there is, of course, also an overarching Western culture, which means that immigration within the West from one Western place to another Western place is a change of culture. But in a broader sense, it is also in continuation of the same culture. I mean, when one travels, or one can go as a Westerner to another Western country where one has never been before and still recognize lots of things as a Westerner. So that's also important to keep in mind when it comes to multiculturalism. Maybe this is something we're going to get into more, but the idea that these things can be combined, however, also comes from the fact that a lot of cultural manifestations have been watered down, and they can only be combined because they have been watered down. If a culture remains very strong in its self-confidence, then it is much more difficult to combine it with another culture, with segments of another culture. These are all things that have to be taken into consideration when we say, okay, can these things be combined or not? When we say that that two different religions, for example, can coexist, it's often because those religions themselves have been watered down and they are not anymore what they used to be. And that applies not just for religions.
True.
Yeah, for religions and also for many other manifestations of cultural expression.
Right. Thank you very much. So I want to, the way I look at it is that whenever we're talking about culture, we need to be very specific. We can't be talking about culture abstractly. We're talking about specific human culture and space that is shared by people who live in a particular place and they have, let's say, problems to deal with and they're dealing with adopting their culture. So whenever we're talking about multiculturalism, I think we are talking about multiculturalist experiments. And I think in some cases, they may seem to be working, but in other cases, but there are several questions there. So is this just the calm before the storm? Or are there just significant cultural continuities between the several groups that are called to coexist in a particular multicultural experiment? And I think ultimately this is an empirical question, but the question that when it comes to multiculturalism and multicultural experiments, I think the main thing a lot of people have in mind, especially when they're talking about politics, is Islam in Europe. And I think that this is a really difficult question because on the one hand, we're talking about Islamic culture and European culture. But if we talk about European culture, it's a very abstract term. There are all sorts of cultures within Europe that can be considered European without necessarily implying that there is such a thing as European culture. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So this is a really complex situation. So would you say that there is such a thing as a European culture? And if there is, could we use this as a sort of criterion to see whether Islamic culture can be compatible with it, in particular multicultural experiments within Europe?
My quick answer to that question is yes. But there is a word that you used, which I think is very important, namely the word continuity. So there is, as you say, there are obviously different European cultures. But you and I, for example, we could both personally attest to the fact that there is that continuity. You come from Greece and you live in England. I was born in Sweden. I live in the United States, also lived in other European countries. And yes, every time we have switched country, and I'm sure you know what I mean, there have been certain adjustments that have been necessary. But we have still been able to carry on what we do in a fairly normal way, if you will. And the adjustments that may have been required for us, well, maybe I shouldn't put words in your mouth, actually, but I think maybe for a lot of people in our situation, the adjustments that we have to make are fairly superficial. And because there is a continuity there, even though, again, obviously a Sicilian is going to be very different from a Norwegian in lots of different ways, but they can still come together and live under a particular form of government, for example, without too much friction. That continuity breaks when it comes to Islam. Now, the reason why that break has not been made, has not become more apparent earlier on, if you will, to a lot of people, is, to touch on something that I mentioned before, is because the Christian European culture has been so watered down. And because it has been so watered down, and because a lot of people don't have the religious mindset, if you will, anymore, that break hasn't become so obvious. If European peoples had been more religious, always going to church on Sundays and believing fervently in God and so on, that break would have been much more apparent, which is why earlier generations really of Europeans, of Westerners, understood this much better than we do today. By earlier generations, I mean basically through the 19th century or so, if you will, but especially pre-Enlightenment, but even after the Enlightenment and up until maybe early 20th century or so, first half, they understood this much better. They understood that break much better than we do, the lack of continuity there, because there we're not speaking of questions of degree. We're really speaking of questions of kind when it comes to Christianity and Islam, and that's because we do not... and that's because Christianity and Islam are so fundamentally different, not just in terms of theological aspects, but also in terms of worldly, governmental, political aspects. If anything, the worldly aspects, the worldly differences might be even stronger than the theological differences, although, of course, there are also many theological differences. And that is something that Europeans need to begin to understand. We haven't, it's, the problem also is that Europeans, I include Americans here to some extent as well, but we're not as exposed to Islam here in the United States, of course, as many peoples are in Northern and Western Europe. But the issue is that even though most Europeans today have left religion behind and therefore do not understand what a religion genuinely is, they are still inheritors of a Christian tradition in the sense that they tend to, and this is especially true of the Protestant peoples more so than of the Catholic peoples, they have a Protestant and especially a Lutheran understanding of what religion is. That is to say, they believe that religion is about direct personal communication between the believer and God. And if that's all religion is, and that's a very, that's all religion is, but if that is the main facet of religion, this quite Lutheran conception, then there should be no problem in I communicating directly to my God in one way and this Muslim over here communicating to his God in a different way. We can do it side by side. That's not a problem. And so in that sense, European peoples are still very clearly Protestant. Again, talking now mostly about you know, Scandinavians and Germans and the English, who are also Protestant, different type of Protestant, but still. And that conception, that religious worldview, even for those people who are no longer religious, remains. And so there is a lack of understanding of the fact that the Islamic worldview includes the political. Catholics sometimes have a slightly better understanding of this. I mean, slightly better sometimes because the political dimension, because of the pontiff and so on, is slightly stronger in Catholicism. But by and large, that understanding has been lost as well. And so there is really no longer a question of continuity. It is a very clear break between those two worldviews.
Right. So these are mostly religious distinctions that you mentioned. But I think that whenever we're talking about Lutheranism, there is always the question of the implication of the separation between church and state.
Right.
And that implies that a lot of Europeans, particularly those of a Protestant background or those who have been influenced by a Protestant culture, even if they claim themselves to be atheists, they adopt a more, they think that the separation between church and state is a civilizational given, and they use this as a means to understand other people. Do you think that this is a particular mistake that a lot of Europeans are susceptible to, or a lot of Westerners are susceptible to when they're in contact with foreign cultures?
Absolutely. And this is a type of, maybe arrogance is too strong a word because they're not aware that they're doing it, but ignorance certainly of other ways, of non-Western ways of the world. They think that other peoples see the nexus of politics and religion in the same way as we do. And the problem is that we really need a different, a whole different set of terms for some of these things. The fact that we speak of religion on the one hand and we speak of politics on the other hand, that in itself is already a problem because that leads us to believe that in other cultures, or at least in some other cultures, these two are very distinct entities. Now, of course, in Islam, you can still distinguish, as in any spiritual or religious system, you can still distinguish between worldly concerns or political concerns on the one hand and theological concerns on the other. Of course, I'm not saying that they're identical, but the fact is that in the Islamic conception as a whole, and Islam we think of as a religion, that distinction that we have religion is one thing, politics is another, does not exist in the same way at all. And this is why when, for example, a Christian missionary tries to make a non-Christian become a Christian, he is primarily trying to convince them of a theological worldview. Whereas when a Muslim tries to make another person become a Muslim, again, obviously there will be individual exceptions, but by and large, in a very un-Christian way, he is not just pushing a theological system, but also a political system, or what we would call, again, that distinction already presupposes a Western mindset, but what we would call a political construct or a political system. And that's what, and we don't really have the language to express that. And because our word religion, because of our history, especially after the 30 Years War, but even more so after the Enlightenment, our language is not adequate to express these things because we have this very watered down view of religion. And the first step, I think, in beginning to understand what is happening in Western and Northern Europe right now is to understand how inadequate the terms are that we use. There are other terms as well that are highly problematic that we could discuss, but that's certainly some of them, yeah.
Right, so I understand your views about the general clash between Islam and the West, but I think it would be really good for our audience if you gave us particular examples of where is the clash visible in specific cases. So when it comes to clash of values, because what are the values that Westerners have that supporters of Islam or Muslims don't accept, or values that are not held in common and that creates a problem with coexisting?
Yeah, so that's, how many hours do we have here? Yeah, so basically, the first thing I would probably say is that we have, you mentioned the separation of church and state. This is admittedly, to be fair to Islam here, this is not based primarily in scripture, in the Quran, but as a historical matter, in Islam, the prophet and the political leader was the same person, and then that continued later on as well, where the head of state was also the head of the church, head of the mosque, head of the religious system. Again, that wasn't always the case, but as a historical matter, that has tended to be the case in the Islamic world. So that's the first thing I think that we need to understand, which means that the head of state, Europeans have to understand that their heads of state are by their very nature unacceptable to a mainstream Islamic worldview. And it's important to say mainstream here because it's not some tiny minority fringe. This is really, we're talking about mainstream here. And that then expresses itself, of course, in many other ways. Along with that, we have, of course, the maybe most obviously the inferior position of women in Islamic society. Now, again, as apologists of Islam will always point out, the Quran, and this is true, does contain a number of provisions for the correct and just treatment of women, for example, in divorce proceedings and so on. That's all there, and was quite liberal, probably for its time and place. But of course, times change and places change. And now that it is certainly the case that our worldview today of equality of the sexes is intolerable, and of course this is an area where where conservatives might say that maybe the Muslims have a point here, and one sometimes sees on certain fringes, if you will, of the right a respect for Islam for this reason. And for certain similar reasons. But it's important to understand that even if we say from a more nowadays conservative point of view that there are differences between men and women, it shouldn't be conservative, really. It should be common sense. But even if we say that, the subjugation of women is still something that most people today wouldn't accept, even on the more conservative side. And I mean, I could go on. The fact that non-Muslims, everybody should become a Muslim. Ultimately, and the fact that Christians and Jews exist in society could be accepted and has sometimes been accepted, historically speaking, because they are people of the book, but they should nonetheless be subjugated to the Islamic population. Doesn't mean that they should necessarily be forcibly converted. Many Muslims, including, you know, respected scholars in Islamic jurisprudence, would say that you should not forcibly convert anyone to Islam, but they are still subjugated non-Muslims, and they live as a second-class population. All of these things have to be understood by Europeans. It has to be understood that if the current trend continues, then these are all things that will come to pass. We already see this. I mean, if we had had this conversation 10 years ago, we would be speaking in the future tense But I think today we can speak increasingly in the present tense, because we see this in a number of European countries, how already accommodations have been made for the Islamic worldview, and that's going to become more and more extreme. And a lot of the ruling classes don't notice this because they, of course, live in wealthier non-Islamic enclaves of their cities. It's, as always, the lower classes that have to suffer the consequences of the policies of the upper classes. And we see that a lot now in poorer neighborhoods where Islamic immigrants move in.
Right. Thank you. And there is so much to unpack here and to ask you. But I want to start with talking about the leadership, because you mentioned that from a Muslim's perspective, you could say secular leadership of European countries is unacceptable. Why is it that the leadership doesn't see this?
Because the leadership, I would say there one reason is probably that what I just mentioned, namely that they themselves don't rub elbows with Muslims a lot. They might do them at certain cultural events where they go to do a ribbon cutting event or something like this. Or I saw recently, just the other day, a video of King Charles packing dates to break the Ramadan, and so they meet some Muslims on that occasion. But that's a very superficial type of event, because they're just there. The cameras are rolling, and everything is very nice and festive, and so on. One that's not really to be in contact with the culture. One is genuinely in contact with the culture if one lives in the same apartment building and one's neighbors are all Muslim, and so on. One notices these things then in a much more real way. So that's one reason. Another reason, I think, is simply that they have also been trained and educated in the pieties of multiculturalism, as many people in the lower classes have as well. But the lower classes tend to be slightly more immune to those pieties because, again, they live. They live the contradiction of those pieties every day as part of their daily lives, and so they see in a more different way that not everything here is what it's said to be. So I think those are probably the two main reasons. The educational system has been dominated, of course, across the West by the left for decades now. So we have entire generations who have been raised to believe in multiculturalism, and one sees now more and more people starting to break away from that and starting to understand that the lies they were told by state employees in public school were precisely lies. And so there is a reaction now against that, thankfully. We'll see how far that brings us. But I think those are the two main reasons, yeah. Maybe I'll add very quickly one more. I mean, there is the, which is tied to the educational aspect, namely simply vanity. One will, of course, be able to raise oneself above the petty pieties of one's own culture, it goes into orcophobia now, of course, and explain and posit oneself as superior and morally enlightened if one can say that, our parochial culture here, our own culture, is nothing special, and we should all come together in a multicultural paradise. Their vanity is always, orcophobic vanity is always there, an important factor as well.
I'll just share an example from an interview I did with Professor Jeffrey Bale. He told me that the people who were in the national security apparatus of the United States after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they didn't change. They had the mindset that they are dealing with Russia. And when they were dealing with and when they were warned from extremists that the hits were going to be made, they didn't interpret them as extremists. They didn't take them at their word. They thought them that they weren't true believers, and they didn't react to them as true believers. So it seems to me that there is a pattern of dealing with people who are openly hostile to what we call Western culture, when a pattern of not taking them at face value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is one of the most, I'd say, despicable but also dangerous aspects of multiculturalism as an ideology, because it seems to me that it is so forced on people who haven't voted for it in Europe, for instance. I don't recall any vote that said, "Well, do you want your society to lose its identity?" Mm. I don't recall any such vote. But mm. the point is that every time where there is a rise in crime, and there does seem to be evidence to suggest that there is, the reaction of the establishment is incredibly, how should I say it? They just make virtue signaling. They just express sentiments of sympathy with the victims, but then it's business as usual. And they never allow one of the first reactions to say, well, it doesn't matter who did the crime, we shouldn't mm. be Islamophobic, mm. or we shouldn't allow the far right to rise. That's the sort of reaction. And it seems to me that this is a distinctively anti-scientific perspective on the matter. It's like saying that when we do have a multiculturalist experiment, but we're not going to treat it as a scientific experiment. We're going to actually be religious about it. So mm-hmm. is multiculturalism a form of religion for atheist secular governments?
Yes and no. So So yeah, there's a lot of, you said a lot of interesting things there. So basically, I used before the word ignorance, that I should say, maybe I should say ignorance instead of arrogance. But in this case, I think arrogance is the right word, because there is this attitude that basically we know better than the Muslims themselves do what they think. Right? So this particular type of person that you're describing thinks he knows what the Muslim believes, even when the latter tells him differently. And things as, oh, it's just just temporarily
blind. They can't really believe that.
Right, they can't really believe that. Exactly.
And that's premise.
And, yeah, exactly. And this is also an inheritance from the Enlightenment. I mean, we have people like Rousseau and Voltaire talking openly about morality is the same everywhere. They literally write this. All great men in history have agreed on the same set of moral principles, and so on. And this is, they were very ignorant. They may have been good on certain things, but they were very ignorant about non-European cultures. But they write very authoritatively about them, of course, always. People are children of the Enlightenment still, in this sense, that they genuinely believe this. And even now I have conversations with people who should know better that no, this is not what they believe. And we have to explain to them that the different forms that cultural expression can take are so vastly different that it would shock us to see some of the things that are normal in other places. When it comes to, and I mentioned before also that we need a different set of words for this, and this is where, this is one of my pet peeves, but this is where also the conservative, where a lot of conservatives do the bidding of the left, when they use the words Islamism and Islamist, because these words try to save Islam from any form of censure, from any form of critique. Because they say that, well, if this thing goes on, this particular thing that we don't like, well, that's not Islam, that's Islamism. And in making that distinction, they are making a left-wing distinction that is trying to save this foreign culture from critique, saying, well, we can criticize Islamism, but we may not criticize Islam. But we should be able to criticize Islam just like any other faith system. When we use these words, we are then saying that, well, okay, this was not when an atrocity takes place, it wasn't a Muslim who did this, it was an Islamist who did this. And therefore, Islam itself is still safe. And conservatives have to start, not just conservatives, hopefully, but certainly conservatives have to start using these words unabashedly. And reject a certain set of words as insufficient to express what it is that we want to say. And this goes back to what I was saying about the distinction before between religion and politics, that we have to understand the meaning of the words we're using. Islamism used to be used synonymously with Islam in the late 1700s and in the 1900s, in the 1800s. But that changed in the 60s and 70s of the last century, where they started to become distinct. And Islamism was used as the political form of Islam. But again, you cannot say the political form of Islam, because it's really a part of it. It's really a part of the overall of the same overall structure, and so we have to use the same word, namely Islam, in order to describe it. Only once we start using these words properly can we understand what it is we're really facing. But I think part of that, that's an important part in, to go back to your question, understanding that we're dealing with something else. As long as you use the word Islamist or Islamism, we can say that, okay, well, that's a small extremist fringe that believes certain things. Once we use the right words, we understand that it is a major world religion that believes these things. Again, not everyone, obviously, there will be exceptions, and there are, should be said, there are reform movements, of course, within Islam that try to combat these things and that try to westernize, and that's fine, and they should be encouraged. But mainstream Islam itself is still what it is, and only when we use the right words can we begin to understand that actually there is a massive part of the world, including billions of people, that have such radically different views from what we do here in the West about these things. So a lot of it, again, comes down to the proper use of language, which, of course, as philosophers, is our main thing that we always try to use properly. So this has to be said. I kind of maybe went off now a little bit here, but I think mainly your main point was about understanding how other peoples are very different from us, and that there is a real break in the continuity that we talked about previously.
Another thing that seems to me to be very weird about multiculturalism is that it looks like it's the people who have to lose more from it who often are its most ardent supporters. And I'll just give you two examples of movements. Well, however big they are is another matter, but they exist. And I want to ask you, how do you think we can explain it? So, for instance, the first is that there are a lot of women who claim themselves to be feminists, who also claim to be, who all almost invariably side with Islam on several issues when it comes to the Western world. And then it's, for instance, the Queers for Palestine movement, which, I don't know, my impression is that people who are homosexual wouldn't be particularly well treated in Palestine. Well, what do you think? How can we explain that this phenomenon?
Yeah, I think a lot of that goes back to orcophobia, really, which of course we've discussed before. So it is partly the ignorance inherited from the Enlightenment. I mean, I'm not going to blame the Enlightenment for everything. Regular people have always been ignorant in every era. That's common. But with the democratization of knowledge, the idea that the illusion of education has not always existed. People have always been uneducated. But in the modern era, we have the illusion of many people that they are educated because a lot of people went to college. Of course, that means that the quality of college education has concomitantly declined. So people who come out of college aren't as educated as they used to be. And the fact that we have information at our fingertips 24/7 also leads to the illusion of education and to the illusion of expertise, because somebody read a quick article about Islam somewhere on Reddit or whatever, and therefore now they are experts on Islam. And so that illusion has led to a confidence on the part of the uneducated that did not used to exist. And whereas genuine education and genuine expertise, of course, is something that's gained over a lifetime of study. And so that illusion leads to this confidence, leads to the idea that, well, I know that that Islamic culture or Islamic culture of a particular Islamic country is the way it is, and I know that this is that they do not that they believe in the equality of the sexes, for example. So that's part of it, this illusion of expertise and the confidence that leads to it, this sort of self-righteousness that comes with this illusion. And the other is, again, that the old adage that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Exactly. Thank you. And so the fact that, well, we are orcophobic and Western civilization is patriarchal and oppressive and so on. And if Islam is perceived as being somehow antithetical to that, then of course Islam is to be supported. And funnily enough, there is almost a tacit admission there that there is some kind of a distinction between Islam and the West, that they are in fact not so compatible. Because if I am an orcophobe trying to suppress the inheritance of Western civilization, and I do so by supporting Islamic immigration, well, that is a tacit admission, isn't it? Even if an unwitting admission, that there, in fact, that there is some kind of antithetical dynamic between Islam and the West, because Islam can be used as a means of suppressing the West. And that, of course, they get right, but they don't understand what that ultimately will mean for them. And there is this just general sort of short-sightedness about how about what will happen. People think of their own lives. They don't think about what's going to happen three generations later. They don't understand. They themselves don't have much to lose, because the transformations that are currently taking place will not fully play themselves out within their lifetime. So they can continue to live in their wealthier enclaves and not feel the consequences of Islamization to the same degree as other segments of society do. But some of them will change their mind, or their children will change their mind eventually. Yeah.
Right. So I want to add something to what you said about the Enlightenment. And yeah. I think that obviously the Enlightenment is an umbrella term.
Yeah.
There were many Enlightenment philosophers and thinkers who believe all sorts of different things. But
yeah.
I think we can talk about trends. And I think one of the dangerous trends within Enlightenment philosophy is the belief that almost everything pre-Enlightenment is sort of stupidly naive at best.
Mm-hmm.
And that traditions like mythology are the infancy of human thought, and that they are ridiculous, and they don't have any germ of truth. And I think that this is a particular issue when it comes to understanding different cultures, because it's not that necessarily they're stupid, it's that they're different. That's one thing.
Yeah.
And also when it comes to the Enlightenment and understanding and the idea of the supreme Western mind that cognizes the world and sheds light upon the darkness of ignorance, is that there's a crucial distinction that is being obfuscated. The distinction between understanding a subject and understanding another person on their own terms.
Mm.
Because it's one thing to be the specialist on a very specialist subject and know things that most people are completely ignorant of, and sometimes they can't even learn because they may be completely technical. And quite another thing to frankly understand another person and another culture, because you have to treat them as to a degree rational in order to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the famous discussions in the philosophy of language in the 20th century. I think mm-hmm. it goes back to Donald Davidson and Willard Quine. They're saying that in order to understand a different culture, if you try to understand another language, you have to assume that there is a substantial degree of rationality in people's mind.
Mm.
You have to accept that to a very large degree they're rational. Otherwise, you can't understand. You can't understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a distinction that is being entirely obfuscated when it comes to the topic of understanding, when it comes to academia,
mm-hmm.
and the elite of the spirit, if you'd like. Obviously, I mean, I don't see it this way.
Yeah.
But I think that there is a tremendous pressure within academia for people who are incredibly specialized on a small subject to think that they have to have an answer about everything.
Yeah.
So they, when they're asked about anything else, their default mode is to treat everything as their own subject.
Mm.
And even when this comes to understanding other people and other cultures.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I don't, I don't know if I have that much to add to that, but I think you're right. And I mean, I was reading just the other day, actually, I don't remember now by whom, actually, but somewhat similar to what you were saying about how understanding, I think it was maybe, G.R. Elton or A.G. Carr. No, I think it was Elton writing against Carr, if I remember correctly. But anyway, about the difficulty of understanding another culture and how it really requires, it requires a whole other set of terms, which goes back a little bit to what we were saying before, but also to, as you say, assume that there are reasons for why they're doing what they're doing, and that these reasons are rational and self-interested. And something which is, I think, undeniable, that's even 100 years from now, right, someone writing the history of the West today will have to try to understand why orcophobes and why defenders of multiculturalism are doing what they're doing, and that even in that, there is a type of, as much as we may disagree with it, there is a, at least in some cases, a rational process that goes into it, even though we would say it's based on a lot of faulty premises. But yeah, one always has to, and this is why we're philosophers and not activists, because we want to take the trouble of genuinely understanding a phenomenon, which leaves some people feeling dissatisfied. I don't know if you've had this experience, but basically, there are some people who just want the activists and the foot soldiers and people screaming down with such and such, whereas we really it leaves them dissatisfied when one is sitting down and calmly trying to analyze and understand something. But yeah, that's our job.
Right. So I want to ask you last question about multiculturalism before we move to the US and Donald Trump.
Yes.
Right. So you have lived in Sweden for a long time. Am I right?
Well, I left when I was 14. Then I lived in other European countries as well. Yeah, later on.
So lately, we are hearing a lot of bad stuff about Sweden. There are a lot of bombings. There's a lot of gang violence and a lot of violence when it comes to underage children.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are used in gangs. What's going on? I thought Sweden was I was told that Sweden was a sort of paradise. And it's also the social democrats who have cultivated this idea of a Sweden that is heaven on earth.
Yes.
What's going on?
Right. Well, they discovered that you cannot combine social democracy with open borders. The social people who talk about Sweden as a socialist paradise or a social democrat paradise, they're talking about the Sweden of the 1960s, 1970s, maybe. And not of the Sweden of today. Back in the, they were talking about Sweden back when it was still fairly, fairly homogenous, which it's not anymore. And you have some Swedes waking up to the fact that you cannot have both together. But the Swedish people are traditionally non-confrontational, and very much so, unlike the French, for example. And so they have still the idea that it's probably just something temporary, something that hasn't it'll pass. Just some,
the GDP hasn't gone up yet.
Right.
To create.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. We just need to just tax a little more to bring in some more revenue, and then it'll be fine.
It will go up this time. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. As opposed to all the other times. And so, yeah, there is a certain Swedish mentality, and one sees it to some extent in Germany as well. But this, it's not, the Germans aren't as non-confrontational as the Swedes, but the Germans are convinced that the state is always right, and so that's why they are less prone to vote for major changes in the state. There is this kind of feeling that what the state has been doing so far is probably okay because it was the state that was doing it. In Sweden, it's more, it's not so much this blind faith in the state, but it is the idea that. People are okay, and I don't want to fight with them, so they don't want to fight with me. And I've known now from direct experience a number of Swedes who are looking around and seeing what's going on around them, and they're starting to understand that okay, it's not quite that simple. But Sweden is another case, I think, of as of so many other European countries, where it has to continue to get worse before people genuinely wake up. Yeah.
And sorry, just a final question, because it is good. It is a pertinent question on this subject before we move to US, to the US.
Yes.
What do you think is the, does the future of Europe look like?
The future of Europe?
In the next, let's say, century.
Oh, in the next century.
Obviously, statements about the future are notoriously fallible and several cases unreliable, but we'll take that with a pinch of salt.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So, but yeah,
I understand the quasi ridiculousness of what I'm asking.
Well, no, I wouldn't say ridiculous, but yeah, but it's certainly we'll take this with a great. Don't quote me on this 50 years from now. But basically, the future of Europe. So there, I would say there are two possible scenarios. The one possible scenario is that Islamization continues. I mean, it will continue, but that it continues without. But partly the Islamization and partly the demographic decline of the native population, that those two things continue in tandem. When that happens, basically the countries will turn increasingly Islamic. It's not going to be this people, when we talk about the decline of civilizations and the decline of societies and so on, some people think that we mean something like the collapse of the Roman Empire with ruins and barbarian tribes roving and roving about and so on. That's not what we're talking about here. The countries will continue to subsist. The societies will continue to subsist, but their forms will change. And public life will become increasingly Islamic and so on. And those who disagree, I mean, they'll still continue to exist, but there will be pressure on people to convert to Islam, and expressions of the native culture will become grow weaker and weaker and so on. That's the one scenario. The other possible scenario is that people understand and they wake up to what's going on, and they vote to governments into power that will close the borders, not necessarily close the borders to all immigration, but certainly close the borders to that form of immigration. And that also starts to deport mass deportations, because in a number of European countries, it wouldn't be enough to simply close the spigot Islamic immigration, but it would be necessary to actually start mass deportations. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but that is in a number of European countries what would be necessary. I know plenty of Europeans who already think that. It's too late, that the point of no return for their countries has been passed, unless there are mass deportations, and I'm inclined to think that they're right. So those are the two scenarios. If that happens, probably there will some violence will be the result of such policies, which obviously nobody support. I mean, I certainly don't support violent confrontation, but that is what would be the result in that scenario. So those are the two scenarios. Which one of those will come to pass? There might be more one scenario in one country and more another scenario in another country. Although, as we see, the West now is unified, if you will, or it's sufficiently monolithic for cultural developments in one place of the West to have an effect on other places within the West. So if one European country is able, just like the United States now has inspiring conservative movements also in parts of Europe, if one European country is able to set the tone here, that would make it likelier for other European countries to follow. So that's why, for example, the German election was disappointing for this reason. I think those are the two scenarios. If I had to put money on it today, unfortunately, I would probably put money on the worst of those two possibilities. That is to say, on continued Islamization. I hope that's wrong. I think that's where we are right now.
Right. And you have expressed a kind of optimism for the US.
Yes.
What does this optimism lie on?
Yes. So first of all, of course, we don't have we certainly have immigration problems here as well. But our immigration is of a different form, of course, than European immigration by and large. So the United States is not being Islamized. I mean, we do obviously see certain signs of it here in New York City, my city. We had, we've had pro-Hamas demonstrations and things like that, certainly. But by and large, in terms of just regular daily life, it's not at all as severe as in Western and Northern Europe. The reason I'm optimistic is because American conservatism is something I've written a little bit about. I don't actually consider myself a conservative in general, but American conservatism is much more positive in its view of the world than similar forms in Europe currently. That wasn't always the case. I mean, there have certainly been very genuine forms of European conservatism and even more conservative than American conservatism. But because of the fact that Americans, by and large, still believe in the superiority of America and the fact that they believe that America has a special place in the world, that they unabashedly believe in God, that they go to church, and that they wear outward signs of their religion, all of those things and others yet are reasons to be optimistic because it means that we are offering something positive. When you speak to conservatives in Europe, there are, again, of course, there are exceptions, but there is a certain squeamishness on the part of a number of European conservatives about Christianity, for example, about the fact that they have something to be very proud of. There tends to be the case that their conservatism has become more negative. That is to say, they resist Islamization, they resist the radicalism of the left, and those are important things. But the question is, what do they offer in return? And as long as one feels a certain squeamishness about one's own past, about one's own history and one's own religion, that offer in return is not going to be as effective as it is in the United States, where there is this almost childlike naivete, if you will, about the joys, about the beauty of one's own heritage, which we still have. And I think that's the main reason why our conservatism has been more successful and is inspiring more people.
Could this actually be bad for the US? Because could it breed a kind of arrogance that also generates the sentiments that we are culturally untouchable, therefore there aren't any cultural threats, so don't take them seriously,
right?
And recreate all the mistakes we have been talking about in this interview.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point. And there's certainly a risk for that. I mean, part of it is simply this, these triumphant declarations after the election that wokeism is dead and the radical left is dead and so on. They're not dead. They're weakened, but they're not dead. But also this sense that, yes, and I think actually what you just said made me think of this idea that, for example, and you see this now with the people like Elon Musk, for example, that, yes, we want the best of the brightest of the world to come in and settle in the United States and bring their expertise and businesses and so on. And I mean, there is a lot to be said for that. And part, of course, of the rise of the United States comes precisely from that. But there is in that triumphalism and in that conviction that the United States is the greatest and untouchable, as you say. There is, one tends to not notice the fact that, well, some of those cultural elements that one would therefore invite into the country are in fact hostile to Western culture. And the risk, I say we're not at risk of Islamization here, but that always that also leads to the fact that we're not aware in the same way in as certain aspects of at least of European society are, that that we're not aware in the same way of what Islamization is or what it means. And although certainly there is this refusal to understand Islamic religion in Europe as well, one at least sees regular everyday people in Europe slowly waking up to this because they deal with it on a daily basis. Whereas even speaking here with conservatives, with many American conservatives, they seem to be, they still have this, we mentioned the separation of church and state before, they still have this very sort of separation of church and state mindset, which is say, well, that's the American way. So other religions are not an issue. They're not a threat. So yeah, that is certainly a danger, what you mentioned, and something that we have to be vigilant about. Yeah.
Well, there are always going to be triumphalists. And
yes,
every time there's a major event, they're going to rush to announce the death of something and the birth of something else. I think it's the same with those who were announcing the death of globalism when Donald Trump got elected 8 years ago.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen. I don't think it's that simple.
Right.
Right. So no, I want to say that, I believe everyone who has power must be criticized. And I think that a lot of people right now look at Donald Trump and they idolize him. And I think that this is not how it is supposed to be when it comes to the actual tradition of speaking truth to power and holding power into account. But I don't want to be a miser. I want to ask you whether you think that he's going to be ultimately good for the Western world.
I
and
do.
If so, how, and whether there are dangers in his approach of splitting the Western camp and actually creating a gap between the US and Europe and
yeah.
redirecting Europe towards other areas?
Yeah. So So there. I mean, there is certainly a whole club of people who think Trump is the second coming of Jesus and so on, and he can do no wrong. Yeah. So that's obviously I don't have much in common with them. I voted for Trump, and I'm very happy that he won. This particular cohort of people, they also tend to be isolationists. And I think they miss the fact that Trump himself is actually not an isolationist. I think he's more of a peace through strength Reaganite in that particular context, which I think is a good thing. When it comes to the split within the West, I think that's probably something that I think that's where the European, some Europeans and this particular segment of the American right have in common, in the sense that they both, those sides kind of play up that split, if you will, because on the one hand, America is perceived as very arrogant in Europe, and therefore that we should move away from the orbit of the United States, and Trump is very much despised by those people, and so we should move away from America for that reason as well. And then in the United States, we have this cohort of the American right, who think that, you know, Europe, they're a bunch, you know, they're just a bunch of warmongers, and they can solve their own problems, and we don't need them, and so on. And so there is this kind of mutual arrogance, and I think both of these sides are wrong. I think we do need each other. When it comes to Trump himself, I mean, Europe needs the United States more than the United States needs Europe. But the United States should not become arrogant and therefore say that we can divorce ourselves from Europe or from the world completely. Whenever historically the United States has withdrawn from the world, what followed was not very pretty and forced the United States to re-enter the world again. I mean, there is a long tradition of American isolationism. That's a very American thing, but isolationism has typically not worked out so well for us. Now, when it comes to Trump himself, as many other people have said, one has to distinguish between the rhetoric and the policy. He has said certain things. I mean, his speech there where he talked about Zelensky as a dictator and so on. And I mean, yeah, that's unfortunate. But I think people misunderstand him. I think people on both the left and the right misunderstand him when, excuse me, when, sorry.
Bless you.
Thank you. When people, when the left say that that he's a Putin stooge, that's not true. But when the right, the pro-Russian right in the United States, I mean that as a good thing. I think they're wrong also. And
okay,
I think what Trump really wants is peace in Europe, and that the Europeans should pay for more of European defense. And I mean, I think that's. It should be, I think that's inarguably right. Well, I shouldn't say inarguably, but I think that's absolutely right. And the thing is, I think for Europe itself, that would in the long term be in Europe's interest, because Europe should, there is both a geopolitical and a social component of that. The geopolitical component is obvious. With Russia behaving the way it does, European countries should have stronger defenses. And number two, it's socially good to spend more on one's defense, because that leads to more people serving in the military, which is a good thing. It's good for a national character. And it also leads to hopefully less money being spent on social welfare systems that ruin countries' economies and ruin their social fabric. So I think that would be, I think it's in the Europe's interest also in the long term to raise their amount of GDP that they spend on defense. So I wouldn't make too much of the American-European split. I think that's something that's being encouraged by some people on both the left and the right, with whom I disagree, but who I think fundamentally misunderstand the situation.
I hope you're right.
Yeah,
and I think that this is a good positive note to end on. And
yes,
it's good to have an optimistic note. Now,
right.
I think that this was an interview where you were a bit more optimistic than I am, which is a global first, I think.
Right. I'm not accused of being an optimist, generally speaking.
Okay.
So it's nice to give that impression. Well, I'm sure we'll be able to have a doom and gloom conversation maybe at another time, so we all feel comfortable again. But yes.
Right. Okay. So on behalf of our audience, I want to say that we were very happy to have you again and interview you. And really hope all the best and best of luck for your future endeavors.
Thank you. Same to you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.